They certainly remember September 11th.
Yes, and the Alamo. What they don't know about the Alamo is that slavery was illegal in Mexico, and these straightforward Americans wanted the good guys wanted to farm, you know, and they needed the farm machinery that was illegal in Mexico. I really don't know why we are so ignorant. I have no answer, but Michael Moore, you know, is Bowling, the great documentary about our love for guns, does a thing, I'm told, did a thing in England when he was lecturing there. And he asked Americans, only smart Americans, to come up, as ones who'd been educated at Harvard, Yale, Princeton, what have you. Then he asked just ordinary people, apparent Brits, to come up. And then he asked them questions about geography and history. And the elegantly educated Americans utterly disgraced themselves, drawing blanks again and again and again. I don't know why. Stephen Laycock, a very funny man, talk about forgetting. I'm sorry he's forgotten, because he was a very funny Canadian. But he wrote an essay about Americans. It was called Americans Don't Have to Give a Damn. And I just remember the very last sentence. Last few sentences in the essay was, Americans don't give a damn, never have, never will have to. That's because we're so enormous. And we are really something. I mean, man, if we got the minerals, if we got the topsoil, if we got the rain, the rainfall.
You were writing about, when you were in Schenectady, you wrote about the World War II vets that you met there, and this is what you wrote. You said, the kindest and funniest ones, the ones who hated war the most, were the ones who really fought. Contrast that with the crop of war lovers today, people like Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz, all of whom, incidentally, with the exception of Powell, got draft deferments and never fought in a war.
I've just been thinking about the late Richard Yates, who was a swell rider and was an infantryman like myself, who's I was discharged with two stripes. But anyway, thinking about Yates and his pessimism and his fatalism and all that, and I said, people never recover from a war. An infantryman, an enlisted man in the infantry, learns that death is nothing and doesn't even think of it as something.
In a conversation I think you once had with Heinrich Böll, the German writer, he told you that the worst flaw in the German character was obedience. Yes. When you look out on the country today, do you see that in America as well, that people are towing the line, or do you see a lot of dissidents? I mean, you just took part in a huge demonstration here in New York.
Look, everybody, when you talk, you know, if a Frenchman was coming over and asking me, you know, what do Americans think now?
All 280 million of them.
Yeah, but the whole world is here. My goodness, how are the Armenians now? I have no idea how things are going for them. But I forget what your question was.
Well, it was about Böll and obedience. And,
yes.
And are Americans too obedient?
They are too patriotic in respecting whatever those in power tell them.
Well, you asked about the Armenians,
yes.
These benighted people that I'm from.
You have an alphabet that absolutely nobody else ever used.
Yeah, it's unique unto itself. But Hitler in 1939, just before, you know, he launched World War II, asked rhetorically, who today speaks of the extermination of the Armenians? He knew that nothing had happened to the Turks, and he used that in a very flamboyant and bold way.
There is a wonderful book, and I wish I had a copy. I'd give it to you today, which is called Treasury of Great Reporting. And one is a guy who covers, watches the massacre of the Armenians. It was the Kurds, incidentally, who were given the job, who were trucked in to do the job rather than the Turks. And I suppose we'll be very sentimental about the Kurds. No, but anyway, also observing were officers from Germany, who were interested in killing large numbers of people. It's, you know, it becomes an industrial problem, is what you do with the bodies and all that, because, you know, we're quite large animals. And so they were interested then in killing a large number of people.
Well, speaking of killing of people, I mean, we're sitting here in New York on Sunday looking at the New York Times, an article called Damage Control. The writer here says that since President Harry Truman and even before, American wartime leaders have struggled to balance the need to win wars with the moral imperative to avoid civilian casualties. I wonder how the indigenous population of this country might, what's left of them, might feel about such a comment.
Yes, I don't know how many of them there are left. Noam Chomsky, who is a vested interest in this sort of outrage, anyway, said there were 95 million of them when Christopher Columbus arrived. One thing I heard, I was out in Oklahoma City just lecturing 2 weeks ago, and I asked how the Indians were. They have retreated back into their own culture. They just, you know, they have withdrawn from society entirely, and I think it is such a dignified and wise thing to do.
Terrorism, of course, is the order of the day. I mean, you cannot avoid any media without seeing some discussion of it. But one form of terrorism that is rarely, if ever, discussed is economic terrorism.
Well, no, I mentioned it in a letter to the New York Times, which the Times would not publish.
And what were your comments in that letter?
Well, I talked about, well, it was the case of Verizon, which here in this area laid off 2,400, I guess. But meanwhile, this, two of the officers of the company had become extremely rich. And I was saying this sort of economic terrorism was certainly not practiced at General Electric when my brother and I worked there 50 years ago.
Well, I was also thinking about the impact of economic sanctions on Iraq, resulting, according to most reports, including the United Nations, in the death of over a million Iraqis. And in an article in Harper's Magazine called Cool War, Joy Gordon says that this form of economic sanctions is a legitimized act of mass slaughter. That's pretty strong language.
Well, anybody with half a brain would say that was the case. Yeah, I mean, she's just simply stating the obvious. Yes.
But, you know, we are America. We are compassionate. We care about the suffering of children.
You know, that's not true, and I do too. And so, sure, and I think if I go to the simplest-looking American out on the street here now and told him that you know, we don't like to hurt civilians in any way, he would say, Bush. I want to say something about civilians and all that. The nastiest racist act on this country after human slavery was the bombing of Nagasaki, not of Hiroshima, which might have had some military significance, but of Nagasaki, which was just purely blowing away yellow men, women, and children. I'm glad I'm not a scientist. I would feel so guilty now.
I've been looking at the Nuremberg period, you know, right after World War II, and I found a quote from Hermann Göring. He said that, naturally, the common people don't want war, but after all, it's the leaders of a country who determine policy, and it's always a simple matter to drag the people along. All you have to do is tell them they are under attack and denounce the pacifists for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It works the same in every country. You think it works the same in the United States?
Well, of course it does, and what I've said about the trade towers, and Bush wouldn't know what I was talking about because he isn't responsive to history, is that now we have had a Reichstag fire. And after the First World War, Germany, having gotten rid of the monarchy, was trying to build a democracy and interested in doing such. And so then, when the Reichstag was burned down, home of the legislature, this was such an emergency that all human rights had to be suspended, that the country was in such terrible danger from bad people in its very midst. And So, yes, now the trade towers have entitled Bush and his gang to do anything. It's such a terrible attack on America. And I have said, you know, what are we to do now? And I say when there's a code red, we should all run around like chickens with their heads cut off.
That's Kurt Vonnegut in conversation. You're listening to Alternative Radio. You can get a copy of this program by calling toll-free 1-800-444-1977. Again, that toll-free number is 1-800-444-1977. Stay tuned at the end for complete details on ordering.
Talk about something that might be, you know, deeper in the, again, it's hard to generalize, the American psyche, the idea that we are innocent and we are the victims of external aggression, that we don't instigate anything.
Well, we're certainly turning that around, as we used to pretend that was the case, and we no longer do. We're going to declare war, and I heard one man say about democracies is that they don't declare war on their enemies, I mean, on their neighbors, and said except for Indians and Mexicans.
Okay, I'm going to have a little fun with you, Mr. Vonnegut.
Well, it's about
time. I've been way too serious with you. I'm going to read you a quote and see if you can figure out who said it. Throughout the 20th century, small groups of men seized control of great nations, built armies and arsenals, and set out to dominate the weak and intimidate the world. In each case, their ambitions of cruelty and murder had no limit.
I have no idea, but that's a beaut.
It's George Bush from the 2003 State of the Union Address.
Oh, my God, and I didn't want to listen. I didn't know it was going to be that good, so now you shame me.
Well, you know, going back to Nuremberg, I mean, the whole point of trying the surviving Nazi leadership was to prevent future war, and the open...
Teach him a lesson.
And the opening declaration of the War Crimes Tribunal said, to initiate a war of aggression is the supreme international crime. Now, might not the United States be getting into a pickle here?
Oh, well, of course, as we are behaving abominably, you know, it's like having a relative go absolutely nuts. Somebody finally saying, you know, I think Uncle Charlie's off his rocker. That's right. We are behaving in a bizarre manner now. And I think that George Bush and his gang imagine that they are being political geniuses.
But they'll come back at you and say, hey, we want a democratic election.
Yes, well, so they did. But I call it a Mickey Mouse coup d'etat. And yes, they did. But look, the presidential election is not winner take all, for God's sake. He's promulgating and enforcing his own beliefs and those around him. You have never seen greatness in the presidency. I have. And again, it was a rich kid you would think had every reason to be a horse's ass, as Franklin Roosevelt. And he did what Bush is now doing, is looking after those who put him in office. Well, who put him in office? We all did. And he was humane and wise and resourceful. And it's interesting that he, well, with the aid of Harvard professors, really good guys, I guess, I've heard that there were people walking around the house, White House, saying anybody got any ideas, because the whole capitalist system had crashed. But what Roosevelt came up with is the only utopian idea I have within capitalism, and it turns out it's the only one that Albert Camus ever had too, which was strengthen the unions.
My parents, who didn't know English very well, used to listen to Roosevelt and I on his radio broadcasts, and he had, and I've heard them recordings of him, and he had a very conversational way of talking to people. It was very intimate, and the radio was a very intimate medium then.
Well, he must have had a wonderful mother, and really, but somebody raised him very well. But he was so humane and so democratic, and one would not expect it. He was called a traitor to his class, and sure as hell George Bush is not. That charge would never stick.
Some Europeans have commented on, and even Americans, on the kind of extreme language that Bush and the people around him are using. You're either with the terrorist or against us, dead or alive, I'm sick and tired, and this constant refrain of time is running out. What does that mean? Time is running out for whom?
For us. Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, it's having a relative go absolutely nuts, except you have your spokesman for the country going absolutely nuts and making utterly bizarre statements. I learned early on, you know, this country used to be pacifistic because we felt we'd been such suckers in the First World War as being dragged in on this butchery between Queen Victoria's descendants there, and we were never going to get suckered in again for that reason.
I mean, the Germans and the French particularly are being bashed in large segments of the media.
They're ungrateful.
That's the word, yeah.
Yes, they're ungrateful for all we've done for them. But anyway, I was talking about being raised as a pacifist, and I mean, with permission of the school committee in Indianapolis. And one thing we learned was that a tyrant in trouble or a government in trouble, what can they do? Declare war. Then nothing else matters. It's like chess, you know. It's when in doubt, castle.
Well, again, it's been pointed out that when the Iraq card was played by the Bush administration, it was exactly at a moment where there was an enormous amount of attention being paid to the scandals on Wall Street with Global Crossing and Enron and all these other corporations that were tanking. So it took the attention of the public away from what was going on in the corporate sector to worrying about Saddam Hussein.
Well, only that, is I am told by the polls demonstrate that more than 50% of Americans who get all their news from TV, get all their opinions, think that Saddam Hussein was behind the Trade Towers attack. So sure, have they got ways for getting half-truth out right away now, thanks to TV. I think that TV is a calamity in a democracy. And Howard Zinn wrote a book that everybody ought to have in his house, which is The People's History of the United States, is what was, you know, about slavery and about the extinction of the Indians and about the trampling of the rights of working people and so forth. I've cast my first vote for socialist candidate, Norman Thomas, a minister, a Christian minister. Had to cast it by absentee ballot. And there was a time when I had I guess three socialist parties to choose between. Socialist Labor Party, Socialist Workers Party, and I forget what the other was. There is no such as a thing as a socialist candidate now. And, of course, Howard Zinn, who is a great man, and has pointed out that, and I do it too now in lecture, socialism is anti-Christian, anti-Christ, anti-God. This is because Karl Marx said religion is the opium of the masses. Well, Karl Marx said this in 1844. He was a contemporary of Abraham Lincoln. He said this at a time when opium and opium derivatives were the only painkillers. That's what you took for a toothache. And he said it helped a little. That's all he was saying. He might as well have said religion was the aspirin of the people. At the time Karl Marx said this terrible thing, 1844, we had human slavery as a perfectly legal enterprise. Now, in the eyes of a merciful God, who was more hateful back then, Karl Marx or the United States of America?
George Orwell wrote an essay called Politics in the English Language, and in that essay, he decried the use of the passive voice in order to hide identity and responsibility. So bombs were dropped, people were killed. What do you think about that?
Well, it's certainly true, and again, people are lying all the time as to what a murderous nation we are. What is anybody to do about it? Because the right of the people to peaceably assemble and petition their government for redress of grievances ain't worth a pitcher of warm spit, as I keep saying, as it comes to nothing. And so, yes, as you complain about language the government uses or complain about weapons the government uses. Incidentally, I have a nickname for cruise missiles, which is Timothy McVeigh's. And George Bush wants to fire, I think, more than 100 Timothy McVeighs into the midst of Iraqis going about their business, going about their daily business. And I hear that over half of the Iraqis are children under the age of 15.
Well, imagine in December of 44, when you were captured by the Germans, if you had been labeled not a prisoner of war, but an unlawful combatant, and shipped off to some camp in the eastern part of Cuba to be interrogated without any legal recourse.
I think they're getting food down in Guantanamo Bay. Anyway, if the Germans had put that charge on me, well, I didn't have enough to eat in Germany. It was terrible. Yeah. Yes, no, it's outrageous. And again...
No, but you were treated as a prisoner of war.
Yes, of course. And again, it's as though a very close relative has gone insane, because what people are saying is unconstitutional, illegal, immoral. And, of course, the Pope, not a Protestant, has complained about our foreign policy of striking dangerous countries before they can strike us. He says it sets an ugly precedent.
You've decried the influence of television in people's lives. What about the importance of reading books?
Look, it is hard to read and write. And I say that, to expect somebody to read a book is like having somebody arrive at a concert hall and be immediately handed a violin and told to go up on stage. It's an astonishing skill that people can read and read well, and very few people can do it well. And so, for instance, I have to be very careful with irony, if saying something while meaning the exact opposite, because no, the first thing I say sticks. Slaughterhouse-Five is read in high schools often, and sometimes the teacher tells the students to write the author and everything, and some of them write about, the events are not sequential. it's hard enough to read a book, with Wednesday followed by Monday.
Your father was an architect, he was an educated man, and you've said that you never saw him read a book. But his brother, your uncle Alex, an insurance salesman, he was the one that kind of pushed you to read.
Yes, he did. And his recommendations were absolutely first rate.
Like what?
Well, the prefaces to George Bernard Shaw's plays. Enormous influence on me. And to hell with the plays, just... write those prefaces. And I remember the title of one of his prefaces. It was to Andrew Cleese and the Lion. The headline on this essay is Christianity, Why Not Give It a Try?
And Shaw, who you describe as a hero of yours, was also a socialist.
Yes, of course. And it's perfectly ordinary to be a socialist. It's perfectly ordinary to be in favor of fire departments and... No, economic justice is possible and is not anti-God. But there was a time when I could vote for economic justice, and I can't anymore.
You take pride in being from Indiana, being a Hoosier, and...
From being the state that gave us Eugene Debs.
Eugene Debs of Terre Haute on the Wabash.
Yes, where McVeigh, Timothy McVeigh, my nickname for a cruise missile, was executed. And, yes, but Eugene Debs said, and this is merely a paraphrase of the Sermon on the Mount, which so much socialist writing is, but Debs said, as long as there's a lower class, I'm in it. As long as there's a criminal element, I'm of it. As long as there's a soul in prison, which would include Timothy McVeigh, I am not free. What is wrong with that? Well, of course, Jesus got crucified for for saying the same sort of thing.
Well, with 2 million souls in prison today in the United States, Debs would be very busy.
Debs would have committed suicide, feeling that there was nothing he could do about it.
Well, some may know of Debs' socialism because he ran for president a number of times. But people like Albert Einstein, and we've mentioned Shaw and Carl Sandburg, that was one of your heroes as well, they were also committed to socialism. And in October 2001, you were honored with the Carl Sandburg Literary Award in Chicago. And in your acceptance speech, you talked about Sandburg's commitment to socialism.
Yes, of course. I mean, it's a perfectly ordinary sentiment. And it is... in fact, a form of Christianity is people wishing to imitate Christ.
There's another Hoosier that you write about who really is unknown, and that is Powers Hapgood of Indianapolis. Well, who is Powers Hapgood?
Powers Hapgood was a rich kid. Family owned a cannery, a successful cannery out there in Indianapolis, canning soups and beans and stuff, I guess. And Powers... Mm-hmm. was radicalized, and I think it was possible to happen back then. I mean, he was a rich kid. Powers, after he graduated from Harvard, went to work at a coal mine, find out what that was like. And he worked in coal mines in this country as a Harvard graduate, and then in Europe, and came back and became a labor organizer. He led the pickets against the execution of Sacco and Vanzetti in Massachusetts. And I got to know him late in his life, where he'd just become an official local CIO, and there'd been some sort of dust-up on a picket line. And
what's that mean, dust-up?
Some sort of disorderly conduct, enough to bring the police into play. And so Hapgood was testifying in court about, you know, what was to be done about these people who had made trouble, CIO members, I guess. And the Judge Claycomb, you know, I went to high school with his son, Moon Claycomb. But anyway, Judge Claycomb stopped the proceedings at one point and said, "Mr. Hapgood, why would a man with your advantages from a wealthy, respected family, Harvard graduate, for heaven's sakes, lead such a life?" And Powers Hapgood replied, "Why, the Sermon on the Mount, sir." Not bad, huh?
In Cat's Cradle, you introduced a couple of interesting concepts. One is carass, and the other is grand falloons. Yes. What are they?
Well, a carass is how God actually does business. And there's an illustrative poem. There are many poems in this book. I'm happy to hear you read it, or at least leaf through it. And it is, and a carass is a team of very unlike people who, in fact, in collaboration, do God's work without realizing they're doing it. And the poem is a lion hunter in the jungle dark, sleeping drunkard up in Central Park, a Chinese dentist and a British queen, all fit together in the same machine. Nice, nice, very nice. So many people in the same device.
Would it also be somewhat akin to kindred spirits, allies?
No. Well, now, the Karas is how God really does business. And yes, if you will find yourself feeling kinship for a very improbable relative. Yeah, that person's a member of your Karas.
And the other one was Grand Falloon.
Yeah, well, the Grand Falloon is any political party, any army, any ethnic group. And these are people who imagine that there's something wonderful about them. Is, you know, wherever you go, you find Hoosiers running things, and they're directing the orchestra or whatever. And I don't know what it is about Hoosiers. And I said, if you want to study a Grand Falloon, is prick the skin of a toy balloon. You know, it's nothing. It's meaningless in terms of how God works.
You said,
incidentally, I am honorary president of the American Humanist Association, having succeeded the great science fiction writer and biochemist, incidentally, Dr. Isaac Asimov, in that capacity. But John Updike, who is religious, says I talk more about God than any seminarian.
But Christianity pervades your spirit, and you're informed by it. You're inspired by it.
Well, of course. No, it's good writing. As I'm inspired, I don't care whether it's God or not. It's the Sermon on the Mount is a masterpiece, and the Lord's Prayer is, forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. The two most radical ideas inserted in the midst of conventional human thought are E equals MC squared. That matter and energy are pretty much the same kind of stuff. And the other is, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. Because, of course, you must seek vengeance. And people still, of course, feel that. And George Bush is going to treat us to revenge by firing many Timothy McVeighs into the midst of lives of Iraqis.
You've commented that you wouldn't have missed the Great Depression or my part in World War II for anything. I found that curious. I mean, there was such deprivation in the country. There was such hardship, and then the enormous amount of bloodletting in World War II. Why would you say that?
Well, I actually saw it all. I didn't have to imagine it or read about it. And so, yeah, I was there, and I, for that reason, I wouldn't have missed it for the world. Yeah, I have really been an infantry private. Don't have to read about it. I was it, and that's a matter of pride. I was a police reporter for Chicago City News Bureau, which is the outfit that was the inspiration for the play Front Page. And, yeah, I covered Chicago as a street reporter. I really did it. And I've really been a teacher and all that, and so I'm glad for the opportunity to have seen so much and to see what it really is.
Now, when you go out to these college audiences and give lectures, I mean, you're talking to 20-somethings, and you're this iconic figure that they may or may not have heard of in their distant past. Maybe their father told them about Kurt Vonnegut and a novel that they had read. But what kind of interaction do you have with the students? I mean, what kind of response do you get?
Very warm, very enthusiastic. And you think crack cocaine is a high? try being me and facing one of those college audiences. It is marvelous.
And we conclude with some thoughts from the 1970s. This is a musical mashup of two different speeches by E.F. Schumacher, entitled A Voice for Wisdom in an Age of Folly.
Today the vocabulary is that anyone who calls black black is called a pessimist, and anyone who calls black white is called an optimist. But in the real sense, what we need is optimistic pessimists. That's to say, people who know that beyond any argument now, if they know their onions, if they know any of the real facts, I mean, no one can argue with me as far as the fuel situation is concerned. No one can really argue with an experienced ecologist as far as the ecological situation is concerned. So in that respect, if you like to call a chap who says things are pretty dark, if you call him a pessimist, in that sense I'm a pessimist. But I'm an optimistic pessimist, because I believe that there are now lots of things going on that make change possible. Materially, it's no real problem. We can live on a small fraction of what we're living now, as the culture of poverty, wherever it has existed, has amply demonstrated. The great thing about the really optimistic pessimists is that they're not work shy. And they don't stay at the level of talk, talk, talk. They actually get their hands dirty and do some work. Let's hope we can all graduate to that class. Very few people at the rich end, few as a proportion of total humanity, cannot possibly be a model for the world as a whole. And unless we find a new model, we're just going to drift deeper and deeper into disaster. The rich society norm, whether you say to the world at large, if only you will adopt our technology and our methods, you can all live like little Americans, or little Western Europeans, or little Japanese. That is just plain nonsense. It can't be. A different model is required. We might say a culture of poverty. So we have the people who say we must change the system. And they're quite right. Except one never knows what they mean. Society has produced this production system. But now, the system molds society. It insists that every member of society respects the immanent logic of the system and adapts to it by accepting, that's the only way you can adapt, by accepting its implicit aims as one's own. And in this sense, man becomes captive of the system, whether he approves of its aims or not. And he cannot effectively adopt different aims and values unless he takes steps to alter the system of production. The prevailing concept of efficiency rules the modern world, not by itself. It rules it by the type of technology and the type of organization it has produced. In other words, unless and until somebody has got to work and has produced new technologies, new types of organization, until that has happened, all the preaching, which is also necessary, all the appeal to people's goodness, their good sense, their ethical, spiritual qualities, all this will invariably stay inside the system and will be powerless to alter the system. It will not be altered unless there is an incarnation. That's to say, unless some people actually have got to work to produce new types of work, new types of organization, new patterns of consumption, new patterns of distribution of the population. have produced this and have shown it to be viable. And that's very hard work. For work, we have to have some guidelines, some orientation. And if we've come to the conclusion, as I've come to the conclusion, that these now suicidal tendencies of the modern world, quite apart from their disastrous spiritual implications, could be summed up in four criteria. But any such listing is, to some extent, personal and arbitrary. But I would sum it up like this. First of all, the tendency towards giantism, economies of scale, all that. Secondly, all these are closely interconnected, the tendency towards an unbelievable complexity. No doubt you have seen cars where progress was represented by the fact that you did not have to subject yourself to the indignity of turning a little handle to wind the windows up and down. You pressed a button and bzzz, they went up. These things, of course, break down and then cost a lot to repair. And the simplest things one can't do oneself anymore. Everything has become too complex. Vast expense in terms of capital. You have to have immense amounts of capital to start, to do anything, and a tendency towards ever-increasing violence in the very production processes, from which it follows that if we want to do this work, to incarnate a more humane, a more Christian idea of carrying on, we would have to look at least in the opposite directions, but not only look with our eyes, but also with our hands. Can't we make things small again, reduce them to the human scale, get away from this giantism? Does it have to be so complex? Can't we revise our whole ideas of our pattern of consumption in the direction of simplicity? I'm not saying 100%, because it's that direction that matters. Can't we use our brilliant technology to evolve methods of production where even a little fellow can help himself and doesn't? You don't have to be rich or powerful in order even to start. And can't we go systematically, determinedly, in the direction of non-violence rather than violence? Only with the help of such knowledge and such technology, and it's only not only hardware, it's also software, can we create a system that would serve man in the place of the present system which enslaves him. We are not using the facilities the Creator has put at our disposal for the purpose of attaining an end. We don't even make up our mind what our end is. We are using them, well, because they're there. Our engineers and scientists produce something more we could do, so we must do it. It's got nothing to do with any clear purpose of man to save his soul or anything else, to land people on the moon. Or if someone has come to such a condition that his heart is totally ruined, to make a heart transplant. Or etc., etc., etc. But we do it because it's possible to do. It's a society that is rich in means and poor in purposes. unity is difficult to attain. It's very difficult to attain inside ourselves. Even a saint like St. Paul had to struggle against this lack of unity inside himself. For the good that I would, I do not. But the evil which I would not, that I do. Oh, wretched man that I am. With the mind, I myself serve the law of God. With the flesh, the law of sin. So, this has something to do with God, with unity. And the diversity and multiplicity has something to do with our earth. And uniformity has something to do with hell.
It raises the question of the influence of technology on the whole situation. Is it appropriate to what we really want to do? Now, my own view is that one of the most important things in our culture is a modicum of democratic freedom. Now, is our gigantic and immensely expensive technology relevant to or conducive to democratic freedom? The answer is no, it is not. It is conducive to the development of great concentrations of economic power and the kind of predictions that have been made that in the year 2000 some 50 multinational companies will be doing 90% of the economic work of the world. Well, that is not very democratic. So from this point of view, we do not currently have an appropriate technology for maintenance of democratic freedom. And what interests me most, and has been interesting me for quite a long time, is to mobilize more and more intellectual forces to create a technology for the people. The technological development of the last 50 years has gone away from the people. Everything has become so big, so complex, so costly, and also so violent that only very big corporations can handle it. And ordinary people are left out. They can go around looking for a job, for some slot to fit themselves into. But if there aren't enough slots, then they've had it.
I used to like to go to work, but they shut it down. I got a right to go to work, but there's no work here to be found. Yes, and they say, we're gonna have to pay what's owed. We're gonna have to reap from some seed that's been sowed. And the birds up on the wires and the telegraph poles, they can always fly away from this rain and this cold. You can hear them singing out the telegraph code all the way down the telegraph road.
If you had a technology that is small, then that technology can use small sources of energy, extremely relevant to the whole energy problem. You could heat this building with solar energy, but you can't heat the Rockefeller Center with solar energy. Wouldn't even propel the lifts. If you have a small-scale technology, of course, most of your ecological problems disappear, because nature has tolerance margins, and little skirmishes with nature she could deal with it, but massive assaults, that she can't deal with. If you had a small-scale technology, and only if you have a small-scale technology, can you get a better distribution of population. The fact that roughly 70% of the population of this country live in cities, which between them cover just over 1% of the surface area of the country, entails, of course, enormous energy usage, but cannot be overcome with the existing technology, because it's been produced by the existing technology. So the precondition of any kind of decentralization of the population, smaller towns, a better structure, villages around the market center, market centers around a major town, ideally no major town more than a couple of 100,000 or thereabouts. Everything more is an encumbrance and doesn't serve the human spirit at all. But it's no use talking about decentralization unless one incarnates it in the flesh and creates the wherewithal, the means of doing so.
Speaking about an intermediate technology, something much more normal, human, and non-violent. We have drifted into extremely violent technologies in the last 50 or so years. We use very poisonous substances in order to be able to continue building rooms like this where all natural light is carefully excluded. And if they forget to put air into the room, then it's very difficult to survive. In order to go on like that, we are prepared to use the most violent methods of energy creation, involving even the creation of plutonium, the substance of such ghastliness that the good Lord never made it. He knew where to stop.
When you crack the sky, scrapers fill the air. But will you keep on building higher till there's no more room up there? Will you make us laugh? Will you make us cry? Will you tell us when to live? Will you tell us when to die? I know we've come a long way. We're changing day to day. But tell me, where do the children play?
Now, if you take all this together, then I would suggest that the possibilities of any real change, not in the talking but in the doing, can only possibly come from small groups of people. So, in a sense, we don't really need a theory of decentralization. The dinosaurs, they will collapse under their own weight. The only way to look at them is they're paper tigers. And they have gone through this evolution just like the dinosaurs, and they will end the same way. Let's hope it won't be an ice age. But innovating minorities, they're always small and are ipso facto decentralized. If any one of us still expects any real help from big, powerful organizations, I suggest we're wasting our time. These organizations are big and powerful precisely because they are not, in this sense, innovating. So the best is to forget them. the battle comes between two groups of people. Not between the people who think there's no problem. They will also die away much too quickly. Between the people whom I call the people of the forward stampede. They say their slogan is, a breakthrough a day keeps the crisis at bay. They resort to any degree of violence. They launch Project Independence with a vast and horrifying nuclear program. No holds barred. They have, like the devil, all the most catchy tunes. But the others, I call them the homecomers. They remember themselves. They remember what life is really about. And they do this kind of work that I've been trying to describe. On the one hand, to be able to do our own thing, even to ourselves be a center, that the power of doing is decentralized to me, to you. And at the same time, as a spiritual being, we have only one orientation, to only one center. And only if we have this orientation can we achieve the brotherhood of men, if you permit such a sentimental sounding. A very meaningful word.
Everything to do with money is the reflection of something much more vital. This is due to the fact that we've allowed technology to develop so that only that it's made some people extremely powerful. Then they'll command the monetary resources. There's no doubt about it. In other words, it is not a matter that can be solved by monetary tinkering. It can only be solved by creating new possibilities of living for ordinary people. If these possibilities are created, then we have done everything that needs doing and everything that can be done.
And thanks to Vincent D. of thehealingproject.net.au for that. And in contrast to a lot of what is said about banking by supposed experts, I think E.F. Schumacher hits the nail squarely on the head there. Exactly what we need is a set of alternative arrangements. Now, if you'd like to hear this show again, or any of our 600 and something previous episodes, you can do so by downloading them from unwelcomeguests.net/archive. If you're particularly interested in technology, or totalitarianism, or social control, just click the category link at the bottom of the page, and you'll find a list of Unwelcome Guests episodes which are dealing with those topics. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Now, if you're interested in working on alternatives to the money system, I hope you get in touch. You can email me at unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net.